Thank you, Sebu, for the invitation, and also thank you all for coming on a Friday afternoon, on a wonderful Friday afternoon. So, as Sebu said, I'm going to be speaking a bit about Arab-Armenian encounters in the Umayyad and early Abbasid periods. And I think my first step is to give a little caveat that we really don't know very much about this, that most of our sources talk about political and military triumphs and defeats. So when we're talking about literary and cultural exchange, it gets a little bit dicey. So I'm going to explore two specific subtopics of this field, and these are very disparate ideas or ways of approaching this sort of cultural and literary interactions between Arabs and Armenians. So first off, I'm going to be briefly introducing some common themes in Arabic sources writing about Armenia during the Abbasid period. And these sources have been, for a number of reasons, largely overlooked recently, especially outside of Armenia, since the death of Aram Terhovandian. The second part of today's talk will discuss Arabic and Armenian literary exchange in the pre-Bagratid period. And these are particularly distinct topics, but they have one thing in common. They demonstrate that Arab-Armenian encounters are not bivocal. So in other words, I'm not going to be talking about a world in which Arabs and Armenians are sitting down and talking things out and influencing each other in the literary trajectories of each group. Instead, I suggest that exchanges in the Umayyad and early Abbasid periods are far more fluid, and that we must allow for a polyvocal conversation, including the many languages, religions, and peoples of the Near East. In short, we have to place our evidence of Arab-Armenian exchange and encounters in the setting of the sectarian Near East. So first off, the Arabic descriptions and conceptualization of Armenia. The most informative material that we have on this topic is likely the geographical treatises that are written in the early Abbasid period in Arabic. Not only did the geographers have access to archives that are since lost, several of them have also traveled and or lived in Armenia. They wrote about mosques and trade routes and Muslim communities and goods produced and exported from Armenia. They note that the majority of Armenians are Christians, but they don't actually dwell on Christianity. It's a non-issue without the weight of any sort of sustained polemic. In fact, what we need to keep in mind for this is that actually for the authors who are writing in Arabic, Christianity would not necessarily have set Armenia apart from the other more central provinces of the caliphate, such as Syria or Egypt. So the Arabic geographical texts do not reveal any concern about Christians, or even more than the occasional mention of local inhabitants of Armenia. So it is a bit difficult to use these sources in terms of Arab-Armenian encounters. They're far more concerned with contextualizing the history of the province to bolster their own claims to legitimacy there. There are two main themes that fit into this. First is the Arab conceptualization and governance of the Caliphal North, which is Armenia, Albania, and Azerbaijan. These are in large part framed by the region's Sasanian history. And as Sebu said, I'm in the middle of a book project detailing this, and I'm not going to really go into it in depth, but it's obviously a topic dear to my heart, so if anyone wants to pick it up later, it'd be an interesting talking point. But in short, the Arabic sources maintain that the Arab conquest wrested Armenia directly from the hands of the Persians without any sort of significant understanding of Greek or Armenian leadership in or before the 7th century. Arab discussion of the history of the province frequently centers on Persian rulers such as Anushirwan and Kawat, without any sort of acknowledgement of anything but an occasional Nakhrar in Armenia. References to Sasanian era Armenia are very common in Abbasid era histories and geographies. And in fact, Arabs adopted many Sasanian practices and customs, such as the diwan to pay the local Nakhrar engaged in the military, or the famous examples of neck sealing to mark taxation. With caliphal claims of legitimacy based partially on Arab claim to be heirs of the Sasanian Empire, the stress on Sasanian Armenia and concurrent dismissal of Greek past is a claim to legitimacy in a contested province. The second main concern of Arabic texts is the maintenance of the frontier outposts, thughur. against Byzantium and Khazaria, linked to the Sasanian past by way of Anushir I's famous wall. The stress here is warfare, raiding, and fortification. So there are a lot of regions and cities that are described as fortified borders, or hudud, in the Arabic sources. But the difference here between the hudud and the thuhur is the thuhur are specifically linked to bastions of military might, designed for both the defensive and offensive purposes of protecting and expanding the Islamic polity through jihad, in this case against the Khazars and the Greeks. However, there's considerable data from Arabic, Greek, and Armenian sources to suggest that the borders between Byzantium and the Caliphate were in reality comparatively open and not a barrier to goods, ideas, or people. The stress on the frontier is an example of a trend in Arabic sources, namely that there are two Armenias in Arabic sources. On the one hand, there are Arabs who live and visit in Armenia, and they know the area and they describe specific details that they consider relevant to a Muslim readership. This explains the detailed trade routes and the descriptions of Muslim communities in the north and the locations of the mosques. This also explains references to the border as a bridge between Islam and the other. However, we also see a stress on the borders as a focus for jihad. And this is an example of imagined Armenia. So there's, in particular, we can look at Asa Egger's explanation. He says, quote, "The Thuhur becomes an imagined frontier composed of religious and political ideologies. Stripped of its ideology, archaeology can show a real region of continuity, ecological subsistence, and local economy. However, frontiers, whether they are real or imagined, all have historical significance." End quote. So, for example, Arabic sources consistently identify Kali Kala, or Kanin Kahak, modern-day Erzurum, as a thuhur between the Caliphate and Byzantium. We know that Muslims traded between the two, and we have an Armenian text claiming that this boundary is actually just a ditch. So how can we explain the sustained imagery of jihad along with this explanation of the border as being a ditch? We'd expect that these mujahids are jumping across this ditch to go fight the infidels. Muqaddisi claims, for example, that the area is a great thuhur, where the Rum come against the Muslims. And Ibn Hawqal says that it's a great thuhur with many enemies from every direction. These descriptions continue. And with the evidence of Arabic geographical tradition alone, we would expect that Kali Kala, or Karen, is a main focus of warfare. However, we actually only find two examples of clashes in the area in the 8th and 9th centuries. We'd assume that the strategic position of the city in contact with Byzantium, its status as a pre-Islamic provincial capital, and also the memory of the initial Arab conquests actually define Kali Kala rather than the quotidian experience of what's actually going on in the ground. So the real Armenia, the border is a ditch, but in imagined Armenia, it's a zone of warfare against the other, the Byzantines here. So how does this play into the question of Arab-Armenian encounters? I suggest that despite the frequency of encounters between the two groups, this divide between real and imagined Armenia holds true for much of Arab description of Armenia. When the Arabs are familiar with Armenia, some of the most common themes found in Arabic sources don't belie this familiarity, and instead create an Armenia that fits geographically and ideologically within its Islamic milieu. The frontier and the region's Sasanian past form part of Arab processing of Armenia and its invention as a caliphal province. In this context, we see that Arab and Persian authors of the early Abbasid period go to great lengths to describe Armenia as relevant to Islam and through the lens of Islamic history. We'll start with the most tenuous examples and move forward. In her recent publication about the discourse of place in the Islamic geographical tradition, Antrim has suggested an extremely tenuous link between Mecca and Armenia, specifically in the traditions found in the works of al-Izraqi and Ibn Rustam. Abraham and Ishmael discovered the location intended for the construction of the Kaaba only from the aid of the divine presence called Sakina, which came south from either Syria or Armenia. When the Quraysh later rebuilt the structure centuries later, they made use of the materials of a scuttled Greek ship, Safina. Antrim considers these details evidence of connectivity and continuity, both from Abraham through to Muhammad, but also from Christianity through to Islam. And she says, quote, the use of the term Safina and its association with the Christian North echoes that of the mystical Sakina from Armenia that helped Abraham mark the site for the Kaaba and represents Mecca as a place of convergence and mutual aid between those who worship the God of Abraham. Furthermore, and more directly relevant to the importance of Armenia, the prophet was said to have specific knowledge about the appearance of Alexander's Wall. And this knowledge is explained by a tradition that claims that the prophet himself actually visited Gog and Magog and the wall, thereby allowing Armenia the same claim to prophetic visitation as Jerusalem. Ibn Hajar and al-Tabarani preserve hadith in which the prophet claims to have visited Alexander's Wall during his night journey, although they dismiss the account as fabrication. But Tabari picks up the account and transmits it. He says that the prophet relates, behind them, being Jabalka and Jabarsa, there are three nations, Mansak, Tafil, and Taris, and before them are Yajuj and Majuj. Gabriel took me to them during my night journey from the sacred mosque to the farthest mosque. I called on Yajuj and Majuj to worship God, but they refused to listen to me. Now, Jabalka and Jabarsa are the legendary inhabited cities of the edge of the world, to the east and to the west, respectively. Interestingly, in this account, Tabari actually gives the specifically links them to the Syriac tradition by providing the names of the cities in Syriac. And we'll come back to the importance of Syriac as an intermediary between Arabic and Armenian in a minute. In this account, though, we see that the prophet traced the Quranic story of Alexander's journey from the farthest east to the farthest west, and then from there on to the wall of Gog and Magog. And the interesting point about these marginalized traditions, both the story of the Sakina and also the prophet's visit to the north, is that they very tenuously link Armenia to two of the most celebrated prophets of Islam, Abraham and Muhammad, and subsequently to two of the most central cities in religious cosmography, Mecca and Jerusalem. The conquest narratives help make this fragile link between the prophet and Armenia a little bit more concrete, because several companions of the prophet were involved in the conquest of the north, such as Salman ibn Rabi' al-Bahili and Safwan ibn Mu'attal al-Sulami. Sulami was martyred during the conquest of the north, and his tomb is described as part of Fourth Armenia. At a later date, al-Qazwini preserved this fascinating account about the Muslim pilgrimage to Armenia, including a mosque near Bab al-Abwab in which a sword of Maslama ibn Abd al-Malik reportedly rested in the mihrab. Again, this links Armenia to the focus as being jihad in the frontier. While we have extremely little information about Umayyad and early Abbasid connection to the land in Armenia, these accounts do at least let us know that later Abbasid authors did link the land specifically to the conquest in Umayyad period, that these were particularly the famous points to remember about the land. So for the most part, the Islamization of Armenia took place in the literary realm and divorced of any sort of Arab-Armenian dialogue. In other words, the Arab perception of Armenia, this imagined Armenia, is not a product of Arab knowledge about Armenia or the Armenian people. And this does not mean to suggest that this sort of Arab-Armenian interaction did not happen. Of course it did. Merely that the concerns that are visible as paramount in the Arabic sources are intrinsic to the Islamic world. The defense of the caliphate, legitimization either through Sasanian inheritance or through linking Armenia to Islamic history, and the expansion of Islam. So the imagined Armenia, by far the most significant aspect of Arabic descriptions of the province, was formulated by Arab processing of Persian past and ideas, coupled with the self-identification of formative political Islam. I'm going to take a concrete example here. When I first started looking into Arabic sources on Armenia, I came across a passage in Ibn al-Faqih that reads, "The rock is the rock of Shirwan, and the sea is the sea of Jivan, and the town is Bahrand." A little enigmatic, at least for me. It turns out it was pulled from Ibn Khordadbe, who was a Persian administrator writing in the 8th century. He is placing a Quranic narrative, the story of the rock of Moses, in Armenia. And out of curiosity, I started to compile a list. When do we see mentions of Armenia related to Quranic exegesis? And when do we see the Quran pulled up in descriptions of Armenia? And surprisingly, every single entry on this list related to Alexander, the Wall of Gog and Magog, the Rock of Moses, the Biblical or Quranic North. Furthermore, the descriptions in Arabic were clearly dependent on a multi-confessional polyvocal discussion that did not boil down to simplistic Armenian Arab discussions. Arabic descriptions of Alexander were linked to Armenia via Syriac literature, Persian tradition, legends, and even Jewish tradition. And I think that there's a large body of scholarship on that, so I don't want to dwell on it too much, from Noldeke on to Travis Zalde. Here, I want to briefly mention another element of the Alexander legends that may help explain this sort of gap between the real and the imagined Armenias. The link between mountainous territory, and specifically the mountain range Al-Kaf, and linguistic diversity. Arabic sources, following Syriac literature in general and the memoir of Alexander in particular, locate Al-Kaf, the mountain boundary of the world, in Armenia. For example, Al-Tawhidi could mention this sort of crazy comment, "Send me to Al-Kaf, past the Byzantines, to the wall, to the Gog of to Gog and Magog, to a place that Dhul-Qarnayn, Alexander, did not reach and Al-Khidr did not know." And Al-Balami, in his Persian translation of Tabari, also links Al-Kaf with Alexander and the land of darkness located in the north. This demonstrates the relationship with the Syriac tradition about the mountain barrier and about Alexander, as a Syriac memra claimed that Alexander, quote, looked at the mountain which encircled the whole world, the great boundary which God had established from everlasting. And so the Caucasus became, at least in some Arabic sources, Al-Kaf, an extension of its place as a frontier, as Abu Dulaf says, past which there is no Islam. Local Arabs and Armenians, of course, knew that the world extended beyond Armenia, but Arabs in the center created this sort of patina for the province that allowed the edge of Islam to become the edge of the world, such that a princess in 1001 Nights could threaten, "I could instantly cause your capital to be transported to the middle of the ocean, nay, beyond the Mount Caucasus." This transformation was dependent on exchange between Arabic and Armenian, Arabic and Syriac literature, not Armenian, and further engaged Persian themes and reinvented them to fit the circumstances of early Islam. Linked to mountainous territory is the idea of linguistic diversity. One very famous phrase about Armenia is Jabal al-Awsun, the mountain of languages. Arabs know that people in Armenia speak Armenian. Muqaddisi, for example, writes that people in Armenia speak Armenian, while people in Albania speak Albanian, though he adds that their Persian sounds somewhat like the Persian that they speak in Khorasan, perhaps suggesting that Armenians and or Albanians speak with Arabs in Persian. And we'll come back to that in a minute. Ibn al-Faqih claims that the people of Azerbaijan and most of Armenia speak Persian, but that Arabic is also used there among traders and rulers, despite the fact that there are local languages, and he focuses specifically on Nashawa, which is the Arabic word for Nakhchivan, and Dabil, or Davin, where they speak Armenian, and Bardha'a, or Partav, where they speak Albanian. So this is the real Armenia. However, imagined Armenia is much less concise. It is Jabal al-Awsun. One famous phrase that slips through many of the geographers' texts is that there are so many languages in Armenia that no one can understand the language of his neighbor except through an interpreter. And we can interpret the popularity of this phrase a couple of different ways. On the one hand, it could just be that the dialects in Armenia were so diverse that to the Arabs they seemed as different languages, or it could be talking even about the many languages to the north of the Caucasus. But one thing that I just want to throw out there as a possibility is, given the interest in Al-Kaf and this sort of mountain boundary of the world tied specifically to Alexander, I'd look at the Quran, which says Alexander followed another way until when he reached a tract between the two mountains, he found beneath them a people who scarcely understood a word. So given the region's consistent connection to Alexander, there's a possibility that some of this memory of this sort huge linguistic diversity is a result of the Quranic understanding of the Alexander legends. There's not, as far as I know, a comparable passage in the Syriac sources, but it is possible that Christian traditions about the north played a role in the formulation of Islamic the exegesis on this passage, since we see the same idea represented in Isaiah. People of Israel, declares the Lord, I am bringing a distant nation against you, an ancient and enduring nation, a people whose language you do not know, whose speech you do not understand. In short, Arabs did interact with local Armenians, undoubtedly. However, their descriptions of Armenia do not always reflect any sort of Arab-Armenian dialogue. Instead, they define the province based on themes internal to their own polity. Frontier, Sasanian legacy, Quran, Alexander, and jihad to defend and expand the caliphate. In this process, we see the creation of an imagined Armenia, in which in reality is less imagined than it is constructed. The Arabs engage in a process of Islamizing the province by describing it through the lens of Islamic history and imbuing it with importance relevant to the Islamic world. In this process, we see the legacy of Persian traditions and an extended engagement with Syriac texts, but not Arab-Armenian dialogue. When I first began research on Arab-Armenia, I took Bullitt's Islam View from the Edge as a major point of reference. In this work, he establishes that much of what we consider to be Islamic orthodoxy in the 10th and 11th centuries was actually formulated on the eastern frontier in Khorasan and then transported into the center in Baghdad. And I expected to see a sort of smaller version of this, that Arab understanding of Armenia happened because out there on the frontier, you know, this sort of view from the other edge, from the Armenian edge, that they sat down and figured things out about what Armenia meant to the Armenians and then would import it into Baghdad. And I think one of the main differences here is the political milieu of the 10th and 11th centuries is entirely different. That during Bullitt's period, he sees the influx of the Turks and the dissolution of Abbasid power, whereas in the earlier period, this is the strongest the Abbasid Caliphate would ever be. So yes, Arabs knew the reality of Armenia, and they lived, traveled, worked, and fought on Armenian territory. However, their view was very much from the center and focused on concerns of the center. The Arabic descriptions of Armenia therefore reflect both the lived experience in the province, in addition to the accumulation of pre-Islamic Persian and Syrian tradition, Christian traditions about the north that are reinterpreted in light of Islamic political and religious expectations. So with that in mind, I'd like to turn to a second very different topic on the docket today, which is Arabic-Armenian literary exchange in the pre-Bagratid period. And here we'll see a continuation of this theme. Despite the fact that Arabs and Armenians worked side by side in the military, against the Khazars in particular, we know very little about actual modes of exchange beyond the military and the political interaction. By the 11th century, we see obvious markers of this interaction. Grigor Magistros' poetry resembles the Qasida, and his work demonstrates his familiarity with al-Mutanabbi. And there's some assumption that Armenians of the earlier period had access to Arabic chronicles. Similarly, there might be ties between the Arabic and Armenian medical texts. However, until we can actually examine these matters a little bit more in depth and spend some time with the manuscripts, we really can only work with what we have on hand, mainly three texts. One has two subparts. There are two Arabic translations of the history Agathangaros. There is the correspondence between Omar ibn Abdulaziz and Leo III, preserved in Hevons Patmagirk. And the third text is Nonus of Nisibis's commentary on the Gospel of John. So I'm going to briefly walk through each of these works to demonstrate that here, again, literary transmission in the 8th and 9th centuries was multi-confessional and polyvocal. We're not talking about Muslim Arabs and Christian Armenians exchanging information or texts back and forth. Instead, we have to really put it in the context of the sectarian Near East and involve many more groups, religious and ethnic groups. So first off, the Arabic translations of Agathangaros. There are two that possibly fall within our period here, both of which are in the Sinai. These are coined by Thompson as AR and VA. There's a third, VAR, that is later, so I'm setting aside for our purposes now. AR is reliant on the Armenian AA, but produced via the Greek AG. Thompson dates this rendition between the 9th and 10th centuries, though Ter HaVondian gives more detail. The manuscript was produced in 6837 of the creation, corresponding to 1328 or 29 CE. Although the original translation was produced as early as the 9th or 10th centuries, though possibly as late as the 12th. He points out that the Arabic was produced via the Greek and likely copied many times, and he gives the example of the Greek name Albinos, which should have transferred into Arabic as Alfinos, but instead appears as Armenios. He goes on to explain that the translator must have spoken Arabic as his primary language, since he mistakes several Greek words as proper names. So the second, VA, is also a translation from the Greek. Its dating is contested, so Marr, who published the work in Arabic in 1905, and also a Russian translation, concluded that it dates from the 7th or 8th century, while Adons believes it was from the late 6th or early 7th, and Tumanov states that it must have been translated at or after the end of the 8th. Terhovandian claims merely that it is not later than the 10th century. The manuscript, like all Arabic renditions of Agathangelos, is housed in St. Catherine's. We don't know if it was produced at Sinai, but the copyist was Christian, and it was preserved in a single section within a martyrology. So both versions were translated into Arabic by Christian scribes in a Christian setting, and via the Greek, not the Armenian originals. Already, the idea of this sort of bilateral Arab-Armenian exchange is already stymied with this example. Agathangelos, though, is a very interesting text to choose to translate. It is quite clearly one of the most iconic histories of Armenia, and one of the most referenced sources on the Christianization of the north of Armenia, Georgia, and Albania. However, one of the primary emphases of the history was, as Thompson says, I want to make sure, Armenian ecclesiastical independence from both Greek and Syriac churches. And this is due in large part to the famous vision of St. Gregor, which is exceedingly important since it provides justification for the independence of the Armenian church and supports the perception of Gregor as a national leader. Gregor described his vision, a man in the form of light descended from heaven and called him by name in a thunderous voice. And in this vision, Gregor saw that the city of Vahashapat with the cathedrals dedicated to Hrebsime and Gayane. The man claimed that these holy martyrs who were martyred have made a road for these northern regions, since they have gone up and made paths for others. The creation of the center of the Armenian Sea was therefore constructed by none other than divine command, complete with concurrent earthquake and thunderous noises, and on the authority of the Armenian martyrs, rather than dependent on Greek or Syriac missionaries. The episode is extant in all translations of the work, whether A or V cycle, including the translation, the Arabic translations. So Jarit and Marr, Thompson and Tumanov have all engaged in a very lengthy discussion about Chalcedonian tendencies in both the A and the V cycles. And I'm going to skip over it here, given the fact that there exist Arabic translations of both cycles. So it seems unlikely that any sort of strong Chalcedonian or anti-Chalcedonian sentiment played a role in the decision to translate these two texts. However, the Arabic versions of Agathangelos do demonstrate that Chalcedonianism, or rather more importantly, Greek claims to the ecclesiastical supremacy over Armenian church was a particularly important question during this period, presumably because of their inherent usefulness in sustaining claims of political legitimacy. A more important implication of the popularity of this group of texts is the interrelation of various Christian denominations within the Islamic world, meaning the use of Arabic to pass on Christian text, and Sinai as a hub of multi-confessional Christian encounters. The second text of interest to us here is Hevons Padmagir, which is often referred to as Arshavan Karabatsi Hayas, and particularly a lengthy passage purporting to preserve the correspondence between Leo III and Omar ibn Abdulaziz. It's one of six texts to preserve this correspondence, a mid to late 8th century Arabic Melkite text of Leo's letter to Omar, which is in Sinai. There is a late 9th or early 10th century Arabic version of Omar's letter to Leo, produced in Syria and housed now in Istanbul. There are two 16th century Al-Hamiado documents that are based on the 9th or 10th century Arabic texts, and incidentally we know that this is a very trustworthy rendition because the Al-Hamiado and the Arabic texts overlap, so we can see common areas. We know that the Al-Hamiado texts, though late, are a faithful rendition of the early Arabic texts. And finally, there's a 16th century Latin translation of the lost Greek letter of Leo. So already we see that Arab-Armenian dialogue must be placed in a wider setting of the sectarian Near East, where the divides between Christian denominations and Islam, as well as between Spain, Syria, Sinai, Byzantium, and Armenia, are perhaps not as entrenched as we might otherwise think. So a few notes about Hevon's text in particular. First, there's been considerable debate about its date and provenance. And obviously I'm including it here in a discussion of pre-Bagratid or early Abbasid literary exchange, so my perspective is probably pretty obvious. The text in Hevon purports to be a translation from the Greek from the 8th century. And I see no compelling reason to doubt this. And I'd point in particular to Hoyland's discussion about this in Seeing Islam as Others Saw It, where he takes apart Garrow's view quite succinctly. I'd also point to Mayendorf's article in which he mentions that this sort of general apathy by which they discuss icons would not have been possible after the early 8th century. So in terms of Arab-Armenian encounters, one point is worth reviewing about the text of Hevon's correspondence. What sort of knowledge did Armenians have about Islam, and where did it come from? Hevon's letters allow us to imagine Islam as Armenians understood it in the early Abbasid period. In fact, the letter begins with the statement, "We want to learn the significance of your opinions, for we have been instructed regarding this. Examine everything, but accept what is good." And without a doubt, the author of Leo's letter was indeed familiar with Islamic orthodoxy. He mentions a number of aspects of Muslim doctrine and orthopraxy, including the humanity of Muhammad, basic information about Islamic law, such as laws on divorce or witnesses, or impurities, a general knowledge of the Quran, including some paraphrasing, and this confusion about Mary, the mother of Christ, and Mary, the sister of Aaron. The detailed information about the Hajj, such as stoning the devil and running back and forth and sacrifice, the belief that Jesus was not crucified, Islamic understanding of heaven, the doctrine of Tanzil, etc. There are several examples that demonstrate that this information is generally correct, though usually delivered in an unflattering tone. It may seem possible, though unverifiable, that if the author of this letter is gleaning these concepts about Islam from daily interaction with Muslims. Some scholars have suggested that the proliferation of texts, both Muslim and Christian, in a variety of languages indicates that there was considerable discussion about among many religious groups. And this is undoubtedly true. The problem here is that it cannot substantiate the idea of Armenian involvement in this discussion. After all, the Armenian version has been translated via the Greek, or from the Greek, and therefore cannot contribute to any sort of idea of Armenian contact with Islam or Muslims. It's possible that even factual information about Islam was actually gleaned from Christian sources. For example, John of Damascus wrote about the Hajj, and that Islamic understanding of heaven was a frequent theme in Greek polemics. Furthermore, Hevon comments on female circumcision, and although this is a topic that shows up in the Hadith, it's actually very rare in Arabic histories and geographies. However, it is mentioned in Greek polemics against Islam. In addition to this sort of factual information, the correct factual information, we also see several details about Islam that have not been accepted into the mainstream. And these include a list of Islamic sects that have not been definitively identified, the belief that al-Hajjaj fundamentally changed the Quran and destroyed all other copies, a charge that's borrowed from al-Kindi. Finally, though, we see the charge that Salman al-Farisi, Ali and Omar wrote the Quran. And I want to take a second to look at this. It's particularly interesting because obviously it's not something that is accepted into mainstream Islam, but it does demonstrate some knowledge of Umayyad era traditions about the codification of the Quran. Mainly, why were these three people chosen? First, Salman al-Farisi is credited with creating the first Persian translation of the Quran, or more specifically, the first surah of the Quran, sometime during the lifetime of the Prophet Muhammad. Ali ibn Abi Talib is included here because he was responsible for compiling the first entire copy of the Quran, which was not accepted by the Muslim community and is therefore not the basis for the codified Quran. Sunni traditions from the Umayyad period claim that Ali was not present when Abu Bakr was named caliph, that is, immediately after the death of Muhammad, because he was collecting the Quran. Finally, one would expect to see Uthman here instead of Omar, given the former's role in the codification of the Quran, and the inclusion of Omar here possibly refers to his role of keeping the Quran. After the death of Omar, Uthman retrieved his Quran from his daughter Hafsa, and it is this copy that was disseminated throughout the Islamic world. So also there's another tradition about Omar that he recalled verses from the Quran, but he was not able to supply adequate witnesses to have them accepted into the codified version of the Quran. So the charge of authorship may be fundamentally incorrect, or at least not accepted within mainstream Islam, but the inclusion of each of these specific people points to the author's knowledge of Umayyad era traditions about the Quran. And this to me is further evidence that it's not necessarily a late forgery. If you'll forgive another short tangent, there is yet one more piece that I think is particularly interesting about Hevon's knowledge of Islam. We see again that there's a sort of limited knowledge of Islam in the text when he says, he references the Muslim accusation that Christians were divided into 72 sects. And this is indeed a tradition that you find in the Hadith, but what the author did not realize was that further in the Hadith you also see that the Muslims are divided into 73 sects, which is not found in Hevon. Back to the heart of the matter though, Hevon's text taps into a broader context of Muslim-Christian polemics, and the text itself claims to be a translation from the Greek, proving only that lines of communication existed between Armenian and Greek-speaking Christians and not Arab-Armenian dialogue. This means that Armenian knowledge of Islam, as far as we know it, which is little, came via Greek and not via Arab-Armenian encounters. Of course, by the 10th century, Tolkma Artsuni, his text includes much more information, new information that is not found elsewhere, and demonstrates more engagement with Islam and the establishment of a different pattern of interaction. I'd point to Thompson's articles on this. But in the 8th and 9th centuries, we're left only with Greek-Armenian exchange in the broader context of Christian-Muslim polemics. This leaves us with the final text, the Arabic, the Armenian translation of the Arabic known as of Nisibis's commentary on the Gospel of John, which belongs in the realm of Christian-Christian rather than Christian-Muslim polemics. Similar to the first two examples, the transmission of this text cannot speak to Arab-Armenian literary exchange, or at very least, Muslim-Arab-Christian-Armenian encounters. The Armenian translation of Nonus of Nisibis's commentary on the Gospel of John instead demonstrates the continued relevance of Chalcedonianism and the close and frequently problematic relationship between Armenians and other Christians in the Near East. The early Abbasid religious and political milieu was merely a backdrop to the development of interconfessional Christian dialogue. So around 815, Abu Kura, the famous bishop of Haran, visited Armenia and gained favor among the Bagratids. The Ishkhan Hayots, Ashot Bagratuni Musagir, wrote to Abu Raita to request the presentation of a counter-argument to the Chalcedonian view. Abu Raita sent Nonus of Nisibis to the Bagratid court in Armenia. There, Nonus engaged Abu Kura in a theological debate and, at least according to the Armenian sources, defeated him, thus solidifying the historic ties between the Jacobite and Armenian churches and further damaged the Chalcedonian cause among Armenians. Nonus's success notably precipitated Bagarat Bagratuni's request for more information from the Jacobite camp in the form of commentary on the Gospel of John. The preface in this text clarifies that the primary concern of the author is Christological in nature, aimed at interconfessional Christian polemics and primarily revolving around acceptance of Chalcedonian doctrine in the Near East in general and in Armenia in particular. It's the story of the commentary, its transmission of Christian thought, and its use of Arabic as a lingua franca of Armenian and Syriac-speaking Christians that makes the text particularly important. The prologue of the commentary outlines the process. Nonus traveled the deserts of Mesopotamia for 3 years and emerged, aided, of course, by heavenly providence, with the writings of the Orthodox doctors. He abbreviated them and, verse by verse, translated the commentary of the Gospel of John from Syriac into Arabic. The volume then fell to Simbat Bagratuni, who ordered its translation from Arabic into Armenian. After Simbat's arrest, the transcript passed to Mariam Bagratuni of Sunik, who then again ordered its translation into Armenian. And the extent of Armenian fluency in Arabic cannot be determined from this text alone, of course. It seems highly likely that many Armenians spoke Arabic and were bilingual and conversant in Arabic. But this document at least cannot add any sort of weight to substantiate this hypothesis. So first of all, each time the manuscript came into the possession of a high-ranking Armenian, the first thing that they did was to order its translation into Armenian. So several scholars argue that Bagarad Bagarathuni at least spoke Arabic fluently, but the necessity of the translation demonstrates that the intended audience of the document at least was more versed in Armenian. As Utiye clarified, all of this clearly demonstrates the context of theological discussions between communities, that these discussions surpass linguistic frontiers, and the literary role played by Arabic. Arabic, despite being understood by princes, was not understood by all of the Armenian population at that time, and that holds true for Georgia as well. In fact, the translator comments specifically on his lack of ability to produce the translation, even though this comment seems likely to be intended to stress the translator's humility rather than ineptitude. So Nonis's commentary on the Gospel of John makes it clear that the issues of the pre-Islamic period continue to be the primary concern among Christians of the Near East. The cultural influence of the Arabs and the rise of Islam may have changed the tenor of the debate, primarily the Arabic as lingua franca, but we still cannot speak about the significance of interaction between Armenian Christians and Arab Muslims. All three of these texts, Nonis's commentary, Hevon's correspondence, and the Arabic versions of Agathangelos, demonstrate similar points. Mainly, literary exchange involving Arabic and Armenian is a testimony to the ideological ties and fault lines within the Christian communities, and are a product of interactions between Greeks, Armenians, Arabs, and Syrians. Further, together, they demonstrate the sustained importance of confessional infighting. Chalcedonian views rise as the most important doctrinal concern of the time period, and not Islam. Armenian interaction with Arab Muslims or the refutation of Islam is not the primary or even a secondary concern. The appearance of Armenian-Arabic translations and texts common to both Arabic and Armenian literatures can only tell us about the religious diversity in the Near East and the confessional concerns of the Christians inside and outside the Abbasid Caliphate. So I've talked about a lot of diverse material over the past few minutes and skimmed over some pretty deep pockets of scholarship, so I thought I'd take a second just to recoup with some general comment, generalizations of what ties together several of these points. And the main point here is that the production of Arabic literature about Armenia and in the transmission of ideas between Arabic and Armenian-speaking people in the Umayyad and early Abbasid periods, we see that the setting of confessional and ethnic diversity plays a large role. We can't talk about Arab-Armenian encounters in a void because we just don't have the data to do so. There's no evidence for it, just these tidbits here and there that may or may not reflect the lived experience or any sort of normative state of affairs in the Near East at the time. Instead, we have a wider community of Muslim and Christian peoples that are transmitting ideas in Syriac, in Persian, in Greek, in Armenian, in Latin, even in Alhamiado. And though this may change with the publication of more texts, and particularly the exploration of manuscripts relevant to this period, I would suggest that the importance of the sectarian setting will likely hold true. We must always consider Arab-Armenian encounters within the context of networks and connectivities within a broader stage in the Near East.